leaned forward and piped up, "Oh, we didn't know you lived up there." Up there, as if it were somewhere to climb, as if they would have to ascend to it, ropes and helmets and carabiners. She had actually felt faint, like there was air in the back of her legs, like she might be trying to show off, rubbing their noses in it. Her whole body swayed. She stammered, "I grew up in Florida. It's very small, really. The plumbing is shocking. The roof's a mess." She was about to say that she didn't have help. Not servants. She would never have said servants. When Gloria, dearest Gloria, said, "Hell's bells, Park Avenue. I've only ever been there for Monopoly." And they had all laughed, reared back and just flat out laughed. It gave her a chance to sip water, squeeze out a smile, take a breath. They couldn't wait. Park Avenue, jeepers creepers, isn't that the purple one? Well, it wasn't the purple one. The purple one was Park Place, but Claire didn't say a word. Why show off? They left together, all except Gloria, of course. Gloria waved from the 11th floor window, her patterned dress against the window bars across her chest. She looked so lost and lovely up there. It was the time of the garbage strike. Rats out by the trash, streetwalkers by the underpass, in hot pants and halters, even in the snow flurries, sheltering from the cold. Running out to the trucks when they passed, clouds of white breath coming from them. Terrible cartoon bubbles. Claire wanted to dash back upstairs and bring Gloria with her, take her away from the horrific mess. But there was no going back to the 11th floor. What could she say? "Come, Gloria. Pass go. Collect 200. Get out of jail free." They'd walked to the subway in a close group, four white women, their handbags held just a little too tightly. Might have been mistaken for social workers, all of them neatly dressed, but not overdone. They waited for the train in a smiling silence. Janet nervously tapped her shoe. Marcia fixed her mascara in a small mirror. Jacqueline swept back her long red hair. The train came, a wash of color, big, curvy whirls, and in they got. It was one of those carriages covered head to toe in graffiti. Even the windows were blotted out, hardly a moving Picasso. They were the only white women in the car. Not that she minded getting the subway. She just wouldn't tell them that it was only her second time. But nobody looked sideways at them, or said a rotten word. She got out at 68th just so she could walk, get some air, be alone. She strolled up the avenue, wondering why she'd ever gotten together with them in the first place. They were all so different, so little in common. But still, she liked them all. She really did. Gloria especially. She had nothing against anyone. Why would she? She hated that manner of talk. In Florida, her father had once said at dinner, "I like Negroes, yes sir. I think everyone should own one." She had stormed from the table and stayed in her room for 2 days. Her dinner was slid in under the door. Well, not slid under, handed around the doorknob. 17 and about to go off to college. "Tell Daddy I'm not coming out until he apologizes." And he did. Clomped up the curving staircase, held her in his big, round, southern arms, and called her modern. Modern. Like a fixture. A painting. A Miro. But it's only an apartment, anyway. An apartment. Nothing more. Silverware and china, and windows and trim and kitchenware. Only that. Nothing else. Homespun. Ordinary enough. What more could it be? Nothing. "Let me tell you, Gloria, the walls between us are quite thin. One cry and they all come tumbling down. Empty mail slots. Nobody writes to me. The co-op board is a nightmare. Pet hair in the laundry machines. doorman downstairs in his white gloves and creased trousers and epaulettes. But just a little secret between you and me. He doesn't use deodorant. A quick shiver splits through her. The doorman. Wonder, will he question them too much? Who is it today? Melvin, is it? The new one? Wednesday. Melvin, yes. If he mistakes them for the help, if he shows them to the service elevator, must call down and tell him. Earrings, yes, earrings. Quick now. In the bottom of the box, an old pair, simple silver studs, seldom worn. The bar a little rusty, but no matter. She wets each stem in her mouth, catches sight of herself in the mirror again. The shell-patterned dress, the shoulder-length hair, the badger streak. She was mistaken once for the mother of a young intellectual seen on television, talking of photography, the moment of capture, the defiant art. She too had a badger streak. Photographs keep the dead alive, the girl had said. Not true. So much more than photographs. So much more. Eyes a little glassy already. Not good. Buck up, Claire. She reaches for the tissues beyond the glass figurines on the dresser, dries her eyes, runs to the inner hallway, picks up the ancient handset. Melvin? She buzzes again. Maybe outside, smoking. Melvin? Yes, Mrs. Soderbergh. His voice calm, even. Welsh or Scottish, she's never asked. I have some friends dining with me this morning. Yes, ma'am. I mean, they're coming for breakfast. Yes, Mrs. Soderbergh. She runs her fingers along the dark wainscoting of the corridor. Dining? Did I really say dining? How could I say dining? You'll make sure they're welcome?
Of course, ma'am.
Four of them?
Yes, Mrs. Soderbergh.
Breathing into the handset, that fuzz of red mustache above his lip. Should have asked where he was from when he first started working. Rude not to.
Anything else, ma'am?
Ruder to ask now. Melvin, the correct elevator.
Of course, ma'am.
Thank you. She leans her head against the cool of the wall. She shouldn't have said anything at all about a correct or incorrect elevator. A busha, Solomon would have said. Melvin'll be down there, paralyzed, and then he'll put them in the wrong one.
The elevator there to your right, ladies. In you go.
She feels a flush of shame to her cheeks. But she used the word dining, didn't she? He'll hardly mistake that. Dining for breakfast. Oh, my. The over-examined life, Claire. It's not worth living. She allows herself a smile and goes back along the corridor to the living room. Flowers in place, sun bouncing off the white furniture. The Miro print above the couch. The ashtrays placed at strategic points. Hope they won't smoke inside. Solomon hates smoking. But they all smoke, even her. It's the smell that gets to him, the afterburn. Ah, well, maybe she'll join them anyway. Puff away, that little chimney, that small holocaust. Terrible word. Never heard it as a child. She was raised Presbyterian. A small scandal when she married. Her father's booming voice.
He's a what? A yoo-hoo? From New England?
And poor Solomon, hands clasped behind his back, staring out the window, adjusting his tie, staying quiet, enduring the abuse. But they still took Joshua to Florida, to the shores of Loch Lusa Lake, every summer. Walking through the mango groves, all three holding hands, Joshua in the middle. One, two, three, wee. It was there in the mansion that Joshua learned to play the piano. 5 years old. He sat on the wooden stool, slid his fingers up and down the keys. When they got back to the city, they arranged lessons in the basement of the Whitney. recitals in a bow tie, his little blue blazer with gold buttons, hair parted to the left. He used to love to press the gold pedal with his foot. Said he wanted to drive the piano all the way home. Vroom, vroom. They bought him a Steinway for his birthday, and at the age of 8, he was playing Chopin before dinner time. Cocktails in hand, they settled on the couch and listened. Good days. They come around the oddest corners. She grabs her hidden cigarettes from under the lid of the piano chair and walks to the rear of the apartment, swings open the heavy back door. Used to be the maid's entrance. Long ago, when there was such a thing, maids and entrances. Up the rear stairs. She's the only one in the building who ever uses the roof. Shoves open the fire door. No alarm. The blast of heat from the dark rooftop. The co-op board has been trying for years to put a deck up on the roof, but Solomon complained. Doesn't want footsteps above him, nor smokers. A stickler for that. Hates the smell. Solomon. Good, sweet man. Even in his straitjacket. She stands in the doorway and drags deep, tosses a little cloud of smoke to the sky. The benefit of a top floor. She refuses to call it a penthouse. Something leering about that. Something glossy and magazine-y. She's arranged a little row of flower pots on the black tarmac of the roof in the shade of the wall. More trouble than they're worth sometimes, but she likes to greet them in the mornings. Floribundas and a couple of straggly hybrid teas. She bends down to the row of pots, a little yellow spot on the leaves, struggling through the summer. She taps the ash at her feet. A pleasant breeze from the east, the whiff of the river. The television suggested yesterday a slight chance of rain. No sign, a few clouds, that's all. How is it they fill the clouds? Such a small miracle, rain. It rains on the living and the dead, Mama. Only the dead have better umbrellas. Perhaps we'll drag our chairs up here, all four of us, no, five, and raise our faces to the sun, in the summer quiet. Just be. Joshua liked the Beatles, used to listen to them in his room. You could hear the noise even through the big headphones he loved. Let it be. Silly song, really. You let it be, it returns. There's the truth. You let it be, it drags you to the ground. You let it be, it crawls up your walls. She pulls again on the cigarette and looks over the wall, a momentary vertigo. The creak of yellow taxis along the street, the crawl of green in the median of the avenue, the saplings just planted. Nothing much happening on Park. Everyone gone to their summer homes. Solomon, dead against. City boy. Likes his late hours, even in summertime. His kiss this morning made me feel good, and his cologne smell, same as Joshua's. Oh, the day Joshua first shaved. Oh, the day. Covered himself in foam. So very careful with the razor. Made an avenue through the cheek, but nicked himself on the neck. Tore off a tiny piece of his daddy's Wall Street Journal, licked it, and pasted it to the wound. The business page clotting his blood. Walked around with the paper on his neck for an hour. He had to wet it to get it off. She'd stood at the bathroom door, smiling. My big, tall boy, shaving. Long ago. Long ago. The simple things come back to us. They rest for a moment by our rib cages, then suddenly reach in and twist our hearts a notch backward. No newspapers big enough to paste him back together in Saigon. She takes another long haul, lets the smoke settle in her lungs. She's heard somewhere that cigarettes are good for grief. One long drag and you forget how to cry, the body too busy dealing with the poison. No wonder they gave them out free to the soldiers. Lucky strikes. She spies a black woman on the corner, turning away, tall and bosom-burdened, wearing a flowery dress. Perhaps Gloria, but all alone. A housekeeper, probably. You never know. She would love to run downstairs and go to the corner and scoop her up, Gloria, her favorite of them all. Gather her in her arms, bring her back, sit her down, make her coffee, talk and laugh and whisper and belong with her. Just belong. That's all she wants. Our little club. Our little interruption. Dearest Gloria, up there in her high rise every night and day, how in the world did she live in such a place? The chain-link fences, the whirling litter, the terrible stench. All those young girls outside selling their bodies, looking like they would fall on their backs and use their spines as mattresses. And the fires in the sky. They should call it Dresden and be finished with it. Perhaps she could hire Gloria. Bring her in. Odd jobs around the house. The bits and pieces. They could sit at the kitchen table together and while away the days, make a secret gin and tonic or two, and let the hours just drift, her and Gloria, at ease, at joy. Yes, Gloria in excelsis Deo. Down on the street, the woman turns the corner and away. Claire stamps out the cigarette and totters back toward the roof door, a little dizzy. The world shifted sideways for an instant. Down the stairs, head spinning. Joshua never smoked. Maybe on his way to heaven he asked for one. Here's my thumb, and here's my leg, and here's my throat, and here's my heart, and here's one lung, and hey, let's bring them all together for a final lucky strike. Back inside, through the maid's entrance, she hears the clock in the living room striking time. To the kitchen. Woozy now. Take a breath. Who needs a master's degree to boil water? She steps unsurely along the corridor and back to the kitchen. Marble countertop, gold-handled cabinets, lots of white machinery. The others had made a rule early on in their coffee mornings. The visitors are the ones to bring the bagels, muffins, cheese Danish, fruit, cookies, crullers. The host makes the tea and coffee. A nice balance that way. She'd thought about ordering a whole tray of goodies from William Greenberg's up on Madison. Rainbow cookies and pecan rings and challahs and croissants. But that would be one-upmanship. Womanship. Whatever. She turns the flame under the water high. A little universe of bubble and burn. Good French roast. Instant satisfaction. Tell that to the Viet Cong. A row of tea bags on the counter. 5 saucers, 5 cups, 5 spoons. Perhaps the cow-shaped creamer for a touch of humor. No, too much. Too whimsical. But can I not laugh in front of them? Didn't Dr. Toneman tell me to laugh? Go ahead. Please. Laugh. Laugh, Claire. Let it out. A good doctor. He wouldn't let her take pills. Try each day just to laugh a little bit. It's a good medicine, he said. Pills were a second option. I should have taken them. No. Better off to try laughing. Die laughing. Yes, move wild laughter in the throat of death. A good doctor, yes. Could even quote Shakespeare. Move wild laughter, indeed. Joshua had written her a letter once about water buffalo. He was amazed by them, their beauty. He saw a squadron once tossing grenades by a river, all merrily laughing. Throat of death, indeed. When the water buffalo were finished, he said, the soldiers shot the brightly colored birds out of the trees. Imagine if they had to count that, too. You can count the dead, but you can't count the cost. We've got no math for heaven, Mama. Everything else can be measured. She'd turned that letter over and over in her mind. A logic in every living thing. The patterns you get in flowers, in people, in water buffalo, in the air. He hated the war, but got asked to go while out in California at park. Got asked politely, of all things. The president wanted to know how many dead there were. Lyndon B. couldn't figure it out. Every day, the advisors came to him with their facts and figures and laid them down on his desk. Army dead, Navy dead, Marine dead, civilian dead, diplomatic dead, MASH dead, Delta dead, CB dead, National Guard dead. But the numbers didn't compute. Someone was messing up somewhere. All the reporters and TV channels were breathing down LBJ's neck, and he needed the proper information. He could help put a man on the moon, but he couldn't count the body bags. Send a satellite spinning, but he couldn't figure out how many crosses to go into the ground. A crack computer unit. The Geek Squad. Quick initiation, serve your nation, get your hair cut. My country, 'tis of thee, we've got technology. Only the best and brightest came, from Stanford, MIT, University of Utah, UC Davis, his friends from Park, the ones who were developing the dream of the ARPANET. Kitted up and sent off, white men all. There were other systems also. How much sugar was used, how much oil, how many bullets, how many cigarettes, how many cans of corned beef. But Joshua's beat was the dead. Serve your country, Josh. If you can write a program that plays chess, you surely can tell us how many are falling to the gooks. Give me all your ones and zeros, heroes. Show us how to count the fragged. They could hardly find uniforms small enough at the shoulders or long enough at the legs for him. He stepped onto the plane, trouser legs at half-mast. I should have known then. Should have just called him back. But on he went. The plane took off and went small against the sky. A barracks was already built out in Tonson Newte, at the Air Force Base. A small brass band was there to meet them, he said. Cinder block and desks of pressure-treated wood. A room full of PDP-10s and Honeywells. They walked inside and the place hummed for them. A candy store, he said. She wanted to tell him so much, on the tarmac, the day he left. The world is run by brutal men, and the surest proof is their armies. If they ask you to stand still, you should dance. If they ask you to burn the flag, wave it. If they ask you to murder, recreate. Theorem, anti-theorem. Corollary, anti-corollary. Underline it twice. It's all there in the numbers. Listen to your mother. Listen to me, Joshua. Look me in the eyes. I have something to tell you. But he stood, buzz-haired and red-cheeked, in front of her, and she said nothing. Say something to him, that shine to his cheeks. Say something. Tell him. Tell him. But she just smiled. Solomon pressed a Star of David into his hands, and turned away and said, "Be brave." She kissed his forehead goodbye. She noticed the way the back of his uniform creased and uncreased in perfect symmetry, and she just knew, the moment she saw him go, that she was seeing him go forever. "Hello, Central. Give me heaven. I think my Joshua is there." "Can't indulge this heart sickness. No. Spoon the coffee out and line the tea bags up. Imagine endurance. There's a logic to that. Imagine and hang on." "How is it being dead, son? And would I like it?" "Oh, the buzzer. Oh, oh." Spoon clanged to the floor. "Oh." Stepping quickly along the corridor. Return and pick up the spoon. Everything neat now. Neat. "Yes. Give me back his living body, Mr. Nixon, and we will not quarrel. Take this corpse, all 52 years of it. Swap it. I won't regret it. I won't complain. Just give him back to us all sewn up and handsome." "Control yourself, Claire. I shall not fall apart. No." Quick now. Doorwise. At the buzzer.
Her mind, she knows, needs a quick dip in water. A momentary cold swell, like those little buckets outside a Catholic church. Dip in and be healed.
Yes?
Your visitors, Mrs. Soderberg.
Oh, yes. Send them up.
Too harsh? Too quick?
Should have said, wonderful, great,
with a big swell to my voice. Instead of, send them up. Not even please. Like hired hands, plumbers, decorators, soldiers. She engages the button to listen in. Curious thing, the old intercoms. Faint static and buzz, and some laughter, and door close. The elevator's straight ahead, ladies. Well, at least there's that. At least he didn't show them to the service elevator. At least they're in the warm mahogany box. No, not that. The elevator. The faint mumble of voices, all of them together. They must have met up beforehand, prearranged. Hadn't thought of that. Hadn't let it cross my mind. Wish they hadn't. Talked about me, maybe. Needs a doctor. Awful gray streak in her hair. Husband's a judge. Wears implausible sneakers. Struggles to smile. Lives in a penthouse, but calls it upstairs. Is terribly nervous. Thinks she's one of the gals, but she's really a snob. Is likely to break down. How to greet? Handshake? Air kiss? Smile? The first time around, they'd hugged goodbye, all of them, in Staten Island, at the doorstep, with the taxi beeping, her eyes streaked with tears, arms around one another, all of us happy, at Marcia's house, when Janet pointed to a yellow balloon caught in the treetops. Oh, let's meet again soon. And Gloria had squeezed her arm. They had touched cheeks. Our boys, you think they knew each other, Claire? You think they were friends? War. The disgusting proximity of it. Its body odor. Its breath on her neck all this time. 2 years now since pullout. 3? 2.5? 5 million? Does it matter? Nothing's over. The cream becomes the milk. The first star at morning is the last one at night. Did she think they were friends? Well, they could have been, Gloria. They certainly could have been. Vietnam was as good a place to start as any. Yes, indeed. Dr. King had a dream, and it wouldn't be gassed on the shores of Saigon. When the good doctor was shot, she sent $1,000 in $20 bills to his church in Atlanta. Her father raved and roared, called it guilt money. She didn't care. There was plenty to be guilty for. She was modern, yes. She should have sent her whole inheritance. I like fathers. I just think everyone should disown one. Like it or not, Daddy, it goes to Dr. King. And what do you think of your niggers and kikes now? Oh, the mezuzah on the door. Oh, forgot about that. She touches it, stands in front of it. Just tall enough to obscure it, the top of her head. The clang of the elevator. Why the shame? But it's not shame. Not really, is it? What is there possibly to be ashamed of? Solomon insisted on it years ago, that's all. For his own mother. To make her comfortable when she visited. To make her happy. And what's wrong with that? It did make her happy. Isn't that enough? I have nothing to apologize for. I've scuttled around all morning with my lips puckered, afraid to breathe, swallowed a bag of air. I should have been a pair of ragged claws. What is it the young ones say? Get a grip. Hang on. Ropes and helmets and carabiners. What was it I never said to Josh? She can see the numbers as they rise, a bustle from the elevator shaft and a loud chatter. They're comfortable already. Wish I'd met them earlier, in some coffee shop. But here they are. Here they come. What was it?
Hello, she says. Hello, hello, hello. Marcia, Jacqueline, look at you. Come in. Oh, I love your shoes, Janet. This way, this way. Gloria, oh, hi. Oh, look, please, come in. It's lovely to see you. The only thing you need to know about war, son, is don't go. It was as if she could travel through the electricity to see him. She could look at any electronic thing, television, radio, Solomon's shaver, and could find herself there, journeying along the raw voltage. Most of all, it was the fridge. She would wake in the middle of the night and wander through the apartment into the kitchen and lean against the freezer. She would open the door then and blast herself with cool. What she liked about it was that the light wouldn't come on. She could go from warm to cold in an instant, and she could remain in the darkness and not wake Solomon. No sound, just a soft plop of the rubber-edged opening, and then a rush of cold over her body, and she could gaze past the wires, the cathodes, the transistors, the handset switches, through the ether, and she could see him. All of a sudden, she was in the very same room, right beside him. She could reach out and lay her hand on his forearm, console him, where he sat under the fluorescence, amid the long rows of desks and mattresses, working. She had inklings, intuitions about how it all worked. She was no slouch. She had her degree. But how was it, she wondered, that machines could count the dead better than humans? How was it that the punch cards knew? How did a series of tubes and wires know the difference between the living and the dead? He sent her letters. He called himself a hacker. It felt like a word to chop down trees. But all it meant was that he programmed the machines. He created the language that tripped the switches. 1,000 microscopic gates fell in an instant. She thought of it as opening up a field. One gate led to another and another over the hill, and soon he was on a river and away, rafting down the wires. He said that just being at a computer made him so giddy that he felt he was sliding down the banisters, and she wondered what banisters he meant, because there had been no banisters in his childhood. But she accepted it, and she saw him there, in the hills around Saigon, sliding down the banisters toward a concrete basement in a cinder block building, stepping to his desk, punching the buttons alive. The crisp cursor flicking in front of his eyes, the furrow of his brow, his fierce scan through the printouts, his laughter at a joke as it rippled along the row of desks, the breakthroughs, the breakdowns, the plates of food on the floor, the Rolaids strewn on the desks, the web of wires, the whirl of switches, the purr of fans. It got so hot in the room, he said, that they would have to step out every half an hour. Outside, they kept a water hose to cool down. Back at their consoles, they would be dry within seconds. They called each other Mac. Mac this, Mac that. Their favorite word. Machine-aided cognition. Men against computers. Multi-access cognition. Maniacs and clowns. Must ask coyly. Might add colostomy bag. Everything they did centered around their machines, he said. They divided, linked, nested, chained, deleted, rerouted switches, cracked passwords, changed memory boards. It was a sort of black magic. They knew the inner mysteries of each and every computer. They stayed inside all day, working with hunches, failures, intangibles. If they needed sleep, they just slid in under the desk, too tired to dream. The death hack was his core project. He had to go through the files, key all the names in, add the men up as numbers, group them, stamp them, file them, code them, write them. The problem wasn't even so much the dying as the overlap in the deaths, the ones who had the same names, the Smiths and the Rodriguezes and the Sullivans and the Johnsons. Fathers with the same names as their sons. The dead uncles with the exact initials as the dead nephews. The ones who went AWOL. The split missions. The misreported. The mistakes. The secret squadrons. The flotillas. The task forces. The reconnaissance crews. The ones who got married in little rural villages. The ones who stayed deep in the jungle. Who could account for them? But he fit them into his program as best he could. Created a space for them so that they became a sort of alive. He put his head down, worked it, asked no questions. It was, he said, the patriotic thing to do. What he liked most was the moment of creation, when he solved what nobody else could solve, when the solution was clean and elegant. It was easy enough to write a program that would collate the dead, he said, but what he really wanted was to write a program that could make sense of the dying. That was the deep future. One day, the computers would bring all the great minds together, 30, 40, 100 years from now, if we don't blow one another asunder first. We're at the cusp of human knowledge here, Mama, he said. He wrote about the dream of widely separated facilities sharing special resources, of messages that were able to go back and forth, of remote systems that could be manipulated through the telephone lines, of computers that were capable of repairing their own malfunctions, of protocols and bulk erasers and teletype printouts and memory and RAM and maxing out the Honeywell and fooling around on the prototype Alto that had been sent across. He described circuit boards like some people described icicles. He said that the Eskimos had 64 words for snow, but that didn't surprise him. He thought they should have more. Why not? It was about the deepest sort of beauty, the product of the human mind being stamped onto a piece of silicone that you might one day cart around in your briefcase, a poem in a rock, a theorem in a slice of stone. The programmers were the artisans of the future. Human knowledge is power, Mama. The only limits are in our minds. He said there was nothing that a computer couldn't do. Even the most complicated problems, find the value of pi, the root of all language, the most distant star. It was crazy how small the world truly was. It was a matter of opening up to it. What you want is your machine to speak back to you, Mama. It almost has to be human. You have to think of it that way. It's like a Walt Whitman poem. You can put in it everything you want. She sat by the fridge and read his letters and smoothed his hair and told him it was time to go to sleep, that he should eat something, he should change his clothes, that he really needed to look after himself. She wanted to make sure he wasn't fading away. Once, during a blackout, she sat against the kitchen cabinets and wept. She couldn't get through to him. She stuck a lead pencil into the wall socket and waited. When the electricity came on, the pencil jumped in her fingers. She was aware of how it might look, a woman at a fridge opening and closing the door, but it was a solace, and not something Solomon would suspect. She could pretend that she was cooking, or getting a glass of milk, or waiting for meat to thaw. Solomon didn't talk about the war. Silence was his way out. He chatted instead about his court cases, the insane litany of the city. The murders, the rapes, the cons, the hustles, the stabbings, the robberies. But not the war. Only the protesters came in his range. He thought them weak, guileless, cowardly. Gave them the stiffest sentences he could. 6 months for pouring blood on the draft board files. 8 months for smashing the windows of the Times Square recruiting office. She wanted to march and protest. To meet all the hippies and yippies and skippies in Union Square, Tompkins Square Park, to carry a banner for the Catonsville Nine. But she just couldn't bring herself to do it. We must support our boy, said Solomon. our sweet little toe-headed one, who slept between us not so many years ago, curled against us, who played train sets on the Oriental rug, who outgrew his blue blazer, who knew fish fork, salad fork, dinner fork, the broad tines of life. And then, from nowhere, blackout. All blackout. Ever blackout. Joshua became code, written into his own numbers. She lay 2 months in bed, hardly moving. Solomon wanted to hire a nurse, but she refused. She said she would snap out of it. But the word wasn't snap, more like slide, a word Joshua had liked. I'll slide out. She began to walk around the house, through the dining room, around the living room, past the breakfast nook, toward the fridge again. She put Joshua's photo front and center. She leaned against it and talked to him. And the fridge collected things that he might have liked. Simple things. She cut them out and pasted them on. Computer articles. Photos of circuit boards. A picture of a new building at Park. A newspaper article about a graphics hack. The menu from Ray's Famous. An ad from the Village Voice. It struck her that her fridge was beginning to look hairy. The phrase almost made her smile. My hairy fridge. And then one evening, the little clips fluttered to the floor, and she leaned down and read it again. Looking for mothers to talk to. Nomvets, P.O. Box 667. She had never really thought of him as a veteran, or having been in Vietnam. He was a computer operator, had gone to Asia. But the ad made her fingers tingle. She brought it to the kitchen counter, sat down, quickly wrote a reply in pencil, then went over it with ink, stole quietly out the door, slunk into the elevator. She could have mailed it right downstairs in the lobby, but she didn't want to. She ran outside to Park Avenue, middle of the night, in a snowstorm. The doorman stunned to see her going out the door in her nightdress, slippers on. Mrs. Soderberg, are you okay?
Can't stop now. Letter in hand. Mother seeks bones of son. Found in blown-up cafe in foreign land.
She ran down to Lexington, to the mailbox on 74th. The white breath leaving her for the air. Toes wet with snow. She knew that if she didn't send it right then, she never would. The doorman nodded shyly when she came back in, cast a quick flick of his eyes to her breasts.
Night, Mrs. Soderberg, he said.
Oh, she wanted to kiss him right then and there, on the forehead. A thanks for peeping. It made her feel good. Thrilled her, to be honest. The cloth stretched tight across her chest, the outline of everything showing, the benefit of cold, a single snowflake melting down along the very front of her throat. Any other time she would have thought it crass, but there, in her nightdress, in the warmth of the elevator, she was thankful. There was a lightness about her that night. She cleaned the front of the fridge of everything but his photograph, made it simple again, gave it a haircut of sorts, thought of her letter winding its way through the postal system, eventually to find another like her. Who would it be? And what would they look like? And would they be tender? And would they be kind? That's all she wanted, for them to be kind. That night she climbed in and snuggled against the soft warmth of Solomon, touched him on the low of the back.
Sol? Sully? Sol, honey? Wake up.
He turned to say that her feet were cold.
Warm me up then, Sully.
He propped himself on his elbow and leaned across. And afterward, she went to sleep. For the first time in ages, she'd almost forgotten what it meant to wake. She opened her eyes beside him in the morning and nudged him again, ran her fingers on the curve of his shoulder.
Geez, he said with a grin. What is it, honey? My birthday?
In they come, cautiously dressed, all except Jacqueline, who has a deep plunge to her Laura Ashley print. Marcia just behind her, all flushed and feathery, like she's just flown through a window and needs to bash at the walls. Not even a glance at the mezuzah on the door. Thank heavens for that. No explanations. Janet, with her head down. A touch from Gloria on the wrist and a deep, wide smile. They rush along the corridor with Marcia at the front now, a bakery box in her hand, past Joshua's door, past her own bedroom, past the painting of Solomon on the wall, 18 years younger and a good deal more hair, into the living room, straight to the couch. Marcia places the box on the coffee table, sits back against the deep white cushions and fans herself. Maybe it's just hot flashes, or perhaps she got caught up in the subway. But no, she's all a flutter, and the others know something is up. At least, she thinks, they didn't meet beforehand. Didn't come up with a Park Avenue strategy. Do not pass go. Do not collect 200. She pulls up the ottoman and circles the chairs, guides Gloria onto the sofa by the arm. Gloria, with flowers in her hand, still clutching them. It would be rude to take them, but they'll need some water soon.
Oh, God, says Marcia. Are you all right? Claire says. What is it?
Gathered around her as if at a campfire, all of them, leaning in, eager for outrage.
You won't believe it.
Marcia's face is flushed red, with little beads of sweat at her brow. She breathes as if all the oxygen is gone, as if they're at some great height. Ropes and helmets and carabiners, indeed.
What?
Says Janet.
Did someone hurt you?
Marcia's chest yammering up and down, a gold-plated bear falling against her chest bone.
Man in the air. What? A man in the air, walking.
Mercy, says Gloria.
Claire considers a moment the notion that Marcia might be a tad drunk, or even high, who knows these days. She might have munched on some mushrooms for breakfast, or downed a little vodka. But she looks perfectly sober, if a little flushed, no redness to the eyes, no slurring.
Downtown.
Drunk or not, she's thankful for Marcia and this little blip of hysteria. It's guided them all so quickly into the apartment, a minimum of fuss. No need for all those niceties, the oohs and the ahs, the embarrassments. What fabulous curtains, and isn't that a nice fireplace? And yes, I'll have 2 sugars with mine. And, oh, it's very cozy. Really, Claire, very cozy. What a lovely vase. And, Lord above, is that your husband on the wall? All the planning in the world couldn't have ushered them in so smoothly, without a single hiccup. She should do something, she knows, to let them know they're welcome. Hand Marcia a handkerchief. Get her a tall, cool glass of water. Take the flowers from Gloria's hands. Open up the bakery boxes and spread them out. Compliment the bagels. Something. Anything. But they're stuck on the swell of Marcia now, watching the rise and fall of her chest.
Glass of water, Marcia? Yes, please. Oh, yes.
A man where?
The voices fading.
Silly of me. Into the kitchen, quick, quick.
She doesn't want to miss a word. The soft murmur of conversation from the living room.
To the freezer, the ice tray. Should have put in fresh trays this morning. Never thought of it.
She bangs them on the marble counter. 3, 4 cubes. A few shards spread out across the counter. Old ice, hazy at the center. 1 cube slips across the counter as if to release itself, falls on the floor.
Should I?
She glances toward the living room and picks the cube off the floor. In 1 smooth motion, she's across to the sink. Allows the tap to run a second, washes the cube, fills the glass. She should slice some lemon, and would in normal circumstances, but instead She's out of the kitchen and into the living room and across the carpet with the water.
Here you go. Oh, lovely. Thanks.
And a smile from Janet, of all people.
But the ferry boat was full, you see, says Marcia.
She's a little hurt that Marcia didn't wait for her to begin, but no matter. The ferry from Staten Island, no doubt.
And I was standing right at the very front.
Claire dries her hand on the hip of her dress and wonders now where it is she should sit. Should she go right to the heart of the matter, onto the sofa? But that might be a bit much, a bit forward, right beside Marcia, who has all the eye gaze. And yet to stand on the outside might be noticed, too, as if she's not part of them, trying to be separate. Then again, she needs to be mobile, not hem herself in with the coffee table. She has to be able to get up and make refreshments, spread the breakfast out, take orders, make everyone feel at home. Instant or ground, sugar or not. She smiles at Gloria and edges across toward her, lifts the belted ashtray off the arm of the chair, places it on the table with a soft rattle, and sits down. Feels the thick of Gloria's hand on her back, a reassurance.
Go on, please, go on. Sorry. And I was a little too late to watch the sunrise, but I thought I'd stand up there anyway. It's pretty, the city, at that hour. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's pretty. And I was just daydreaming, really, when I looked up and I saw a helicopter in the air and, well, you all know me and helicopters.
They know indeed, and it makes the air somber a moment. But Marcia doesn't seem to notice, and she coughs for a pause, a fraction of silence. Respect, really.
So I'm watching this helicopter, and it's hanging in the air, almost like it's doing a double take. Up there, but not very well. Suspended, like, but rocking back and forth. Land sakes! And I'm thinking about how Mike Jr. would hang a much better turn than that, how he'd handle the craft so much better. I mean, he was the Evel Knievel of helicopters. His sergeant said so, and I thought maybe there's something wrong with it, you know? I had that dread, you know, hanging there. Oh, no, says Jacqueline. I couldn't hear the engine, so I didn't really know. And then, suddenly, behind the helicopter, I saw this little fly speck, no bigger than an insect, I swear to you. But it's a man.
A man?
Like an angel, says Gloria.
A flyman?
What sort of man?
Flying?
Where? I just got the heebie-jeebies. It's a guy, says Marcia, on a tightrope. I mean, I didn't know it right away. I didn't figure it out just like that. But what it is, there's a guy on a tightrope.
Where?
Shh, shh, says Janet. Up there, between the towers, a million miles up. We could just about see him.
What's he doing?
Tightroping.
A funambulist.
What? Oh, my God. Does he fall?
Shh.
Oh, don't tell me he falls.
Shh.
Please don't tell me he falls.
Shh already, says Janet to Jacqueline.
So I tapped the shoulder of this young guy beside me, one of those ponytailed ones, and he's like, what, lady? Like he's real annoyed that I disturbed his little standing sleep or dream or whatever it is he's doing at the front of the boat, and I said, look, and he said,
what?
Mercy. And I pointed it out, the little flyman, and then he said a bad word. You'll excuse me, Claire, in your house, I'm sorry, but he said, fuck.
And Claire wants to say, well, I'd say fuck too if I were me.
I'd say it backward and forward and around the block. Fuck this and fuck that and fuck it all once, twice, three times.
But all she does is smile at Marcia and give her what she hopes is a nod that understands that it's absolutely no problem to say fuck on Park Avenue, on a Wednesday, at a coffee morning. In fact, it's probably the best thing to say, given the circumstances. Maybe they should all say it in unison, make a sing-song out of it.
And then, says Marcia, everyone around us started looking up, and before I knew it, even the captain of the ferry was out, and he had binoculars with him, and he said, "That guy's on a tightrope."
For real?
Now, you can only imagine, the whole deck, full of people, their early commute, shoulder to shoulder, and someone's walking a tightrope. Between those new buildings, the World Towery thingamajigs.
Trade Center.
Oh, those?
Listen to me. Those monstrosities, says Claire.
And then this young guy with the ponytail. The fuck guy?
Says Janet with a half giggle.
Yes. Well, he starts saying that he's sure, stock sure, 550% that it's a projection. That someone is projecting it up on the sky, and maybe it's a giant white sheet, and the image is coming from the helicopter. It's being beamed across from some sort of camera or other. He had all the technical terms.
A projection?
Like a TV thing?
Says Jacqueline.
Circus, maybe. And I tell him that they can't do that from a helicopter, and he looks at me like, yeah, lady. And I say it to him again. They can't do that. And he says, and what do you know about helicopters, lady?
Never.
And I tell him I know a hell of a lot about copters, actually.
And she does. Marcia knows a hell of a hell of a hell of a lot about her helicopters, her hell of helicopters. She's told them, in her own house, on Staten Island, that Mike Jr. had been on his third tour of duty, routine fly mission over the coast at Queen Yun, bringing cigars to some general or other in a Huey with the 57th Medical Detachment. Cigars, can you imagine? And why the hell were the medevacs flying cigars? And it was a good helicopter, top speed of 90 knots, she said. The figures had trilled off her tongue. It had something wrong with the steering column, she had said, and had gone into detail about the engine and the gearing ratio and the length of the two-bladed metal tail rotor, when what really mattered, all that truly mattered, was that Mike Jr. had clipped the top of a goalpost, of all things, a soccer goalpost, only 6 feet off the ground. And who in the world plays soccer in Vietnam? Which sent the whirligig spinning, and he landed awkwardly, sideways, and he smashed his head awkwardly, broke his neck. No flames, even. Just a freak fall, the helicopter still intact. She had played it over in her mind a million times, and that was it. And Marcia woke at night dreaming of an army general opening and reopening the cigar boxes, finding bits and pieces of her son inside. She knows her helicopters. Yes, she does. And more's the pity.
So anyway, I told him he should mind his own damn business.
Indeed, says Gloria. And sure enough, the captain of the ferry, looking through his binoculars, he says to everyone, "That's no projection."
That's right.
And all I could think of was, maybe that's my boy, and he's come to say hello.
Oh, no.
Oh, Lord.
A deep swell in her heart for Marcia.
Man in the air. Imagine.
Very brave.
Exactly. That's why I thought of Mike Jr.
Of course.
And did he fall?
Says Jacqueline.
Shh, shh, says Janet. Let her speak. I'm just asking. So the captain swings the ferry out so we can get a better look, and then brings the boat into dock. You know, it bumped against the river wall. I couldn't see anything from there. The wrong angle. Our view was blocked. The North Tower, South Tower, I don't know which, but we couldn't see what was happening. And I didn't even say another word to the guy with the ponytail. I just turned on my heels. I was the very first person off. I wanted to run and see my boy.
Of course, says Janet.
They're there.
Shh, says Jacqueline. The room tight now. One turn of the screw and the whole thing could explode. Janet stares across at Jacqueline, who flicks her long red hair as if tossing off a fly, even a flyman, and Claire looks back and forth between them, anticipating an overturned table, a broken vase. And she thinks, I should do something, say something, hit the release valve, the escape button. And she reaches across to Gloria to take the flowers from her, petunias, lovely petunias, gorgeous green stalks, neatly clipped at the bottom. I should put these in water.
Yes, yes, says Marcia, relieved. Back in a jiffy. Hurry, Claire. Be right back.
The correct thing to do. Absolutely, positively. She tiptoes to the kitchen and stops at the louvered door. Too much farther in and she won't be able to hear. How silly to say I'd put them in water. Should have delayed somehow, bought more time. She leans against the door slats, straining to hear.
So I'm running in those old mazy side streets, past the auction houses and cheap electronic joints and fabric stores and tenements. You'd think you'd be able to see the big buildings from there. I mean, they're huge. 100 stories.
110.
Shh. But they're not in view. I get glimpses of them, but they're not the right angle. I was trying to take the most direct route. I should have just gone along the water. But I'm running, running. That's my boy up there, and he's come to say hello.
Everyone's silent, even Janet.
I kept darting around corners, thinking I'd get a better view, ducking this way and that, looking up all the time. But I can't see them, the helicopter or the walker. I haven't run so fast since junior high. I mean, my boobs were bouncing. Marcia! Most days I forget I have them anymore.
Ain't my dilemma, says Gloria, hitching her chest. There's a swell of laughter around the room, and at the moment of levity, Claire moves back across the carpet, still holding Gloria's flowers, but nobody notices. The laughter ripples around, a reconciliation song circling them all, making a little victory lap, and settles right back down at Marcia's feet.
And then I stopped running, says Marcia.
Claire settles on the arm of the sofa again. No matter that she didn't take care of the flowers, no matter that there's no water reboiling, no matter that there's no vase in her hands, she leans forward with the rest of them. Marcia has a tiny quiver in her lip now, a little tremble of portent.
I just stopped cold, says Marcia. Dead smack in the middle of the street. I almost got run over by a garbage truck. And I just stood there, hands on my knees, eyes on the ground, breathing heavy. And you know why? I'll tell you why.
Pausing again, all of them leaning forward.
Because I didn't want to know if the poor boy fell.
Uh-huh, says Gloria.
I just didn't want to hear him dead.
I hear you. Uh-huh. Gloria's voice, as if she's at a church service, the rest of them nodding slowly while the clock on the mantelpiece ticks.
I couldn't stand the mere thought of it.
No, ma'am.
And if he didn't fall, if he didn't know, I didn't want to know.
Uh-huh. You got it.
'Cause somehow, if he stayed up there, or if he came down safe, it didn't matter. So I stopped and turned around and got on the subway and came up here without even so much as a second glance.
Say gospel.
Because if he was alive, it couldn't possibly be Mike Jr.
All of it like a slam in the chest. So immediate. At all of their coffee mornings, it had always been distant, belonging to another day, the talk, the memory, the recall, the stories, a distant land. But this was now, and real, and the worst thing was that they didn't know the walker's fate, didn't know if he had jumped or had fallen or had got down safely, or if he was still up there on his little stroll, or if he was there at all, if it was just a story, or a projection, indeed, or if she had made it all up for effect. They had no idea. Maybe the man wanted to kill himself, or maybe the helicopter had a hook around him to catch him if he fell, or maybe there was a clip around the wire to catch him, or maybe there was another...